my kind of background, although I'm a kind of sociologist by training and profession, most of my career I've actually lectured in media and communication studies, so that certainly informs my take upon memory. So what I want to do is very briefly outline what I see as a kind of emergent field of memory studies, then talk a bit about the new, well, not so new now, it's been out a year, that's in historical terms, I suppose, that's still a relatively new journal of memory studies, and then finish off with some remarks specifically about the relationship between memory and media. So the memory boom, as it's been called by a number of commentators, is partly owing to how public discourses on our past have intensified over the past 30 years also. So technological, political, interpersonal, social and cultural shifts affect what and how and why people and societies remember and forget. And for me, I think there are three, amongst others, intersecting trends that feed into this rise of memory culture and which shape, you know, this emergent field of memory studies, memory boom, whatever we want to call it. Firstly, a shift from a concern with a historical knowledge of events to that of memory. So notably moving from what we know to how we remember it. And this is exemplified by some more recent scholarly treatments of the Holocaust. And I think this is driven by two intersecting areas. One, 20th century nodal events are moving beyond what has been called living memory. So survivors, witnesses to the great catastrophes and wars of the 20th century are dying out. And that has led to a rise in a cultural and political move to try and commemorate, to try and preserve, to try and remember these key nodal events. And, and that's fed into a spread of discourses on a need to remember in the absence of this kind of loss of living memory or kind of living witnesses to these events, and sometimes called post-memory, which I think Sean might say something about. So, for example, today we've got the funeral of William Stone, the last British serviceman to have seen active duty in both world wars, and that's seen as an important news story amongst certain areas. So for me, there's been something of a commemoration boom, almost an obsession with memorialization and commemoration that's partly been fueled by the rise and quantity of news, if you want to call it news. Let me give you one example from a spoof satirical program that was on BBC called Broken News. They had this item whereby they were spoofing much what I've been talking about now, about the obsessive memorialization and interviewing and talking to witnesses of and survivors to events. And it was called Halfway There Day, the idea that we were now halfway there between the 100th commemoration of whatever, World War II, and we'd go back and say, the spoof was to go back to these individuals and say, well, what were you doing, you know, on Halfway There Day? Well, of course, you know, I can't remember what I was doing on Halfway There Day because we didn't know the event was halfway over. But that, I think, is indicative of that kind of satirization is indicative of this memory boom. Secondly, growth, development of technologies which facilitate very powerful, very instant capturing, storage, and retrieval of both private and public events. You know, we've got this kind of rise of kind of digital, what's been called home media, the rise of the internet, the politics of archiving, museum cultures, you know, and a massively increased intensity and extensity of journalistic cultures at all kinds of level. And this, you know, leads into ideas around the growth and the accessibility of the archive. Thirdly, feeding into what I see shaping this kind of memory boom is a democratization, perhaps an over-personalization of trauma narratives. truth. And this feeds back to what I mentioned a few moments ago in relation to witnessing. It includes the growth in the rise of emotional narratives involving self-disclosure and the confessional, and the ethics of the viewing of distant suffering. That's been facilitated and enabled by the massive portability and mobility of digital technological recording devices. So what is kind of, the broad academic world made of this boom of memory in our contemporary age? The modern study of memory is certainly heavily influenced by ideas of the role of what famous psychologist called Bartlett calls schemata, at an individual level, and what Halifax, a very famous sociologist, scholar of Durkheim, calls social frameworks at a broader level. In forging these shared beliefs about past events through group identities. And following Halifax, this term collective memory became very prevalent in kind of social and psychological accounts. My view is that the growth of the memory boom certainly has been driven and can be linked to the huge rise in media, communication, and cultural studies. And to some extent, I think those fields kind of, particularly over the 80s and the 90s, stole the main areas of the field away from sociology and psychology, although there is certainly a very significant reevaluation of what memory is and how societies remember and forget in those fields. But I think we have significantly moved beyond the point where people wrote about memory-related issues from kind of within their own disciplinary base, with little or no reference to work outside this space. And the value of memory subject to these conditions that I've described is a very important theme in the emergent field. Especially that memory is often been given a very bad press. Daniel Schachter, for example, says, and I quote, "Memory's reputation has been tarnished lately." And the philosopher Ricoeur also cautions against a tendency, and I quote, "to approach memory on the basis of its deficiencies and even its dysfunctions." Paul Connaughton, one of the often seen as one of the leading social anthropologists or sociologists of memory from his very famous, although very short book, Why Societies Remember from the late 80s, has recently challenges both the common attribution of virtue to remembering and commemoration and the kind of associated obligations and the idea of forgetting as somehow a failure and its associated culpabilities. And with any kind of emergent field, whenever you attempt to define something, there is already, to some extent, I think, a memory studies backlash from certain areas. And I discovered this when, over the past 6 or 7 years, putting together the proposal for what is now the Journal of Memory Studies. It's very interesting. Titles are very important to people, and as they should be in terms of a journal. Emailing people saying, will you come on the editorial board of the journal? It's interesting what kind of responses you get. And there was a very famous historian of the British historian of the Holocaust, whose name I won't mention, who would only be involved if we called it social memory studies. Social memory. If social memory was in there. Equally, other cultural studies people insisted on having the word culture in there. But we thought memory studies was much more provocative and engaging with the kinds of developments that I've been talking about. What has, I think, emerged most strongly from the journal and kind of these emerging debates is the themes of disciplinarity and interdisciplinarity. So Susanna Radstone, for example, she cautions about the risks of the pursuance of what she calls transdisciplinarity. She kind of cautions against what she refers to as traveling concepts and hardening orthodoxies. And she's especially concerned with the use of the word trauma and how that is translated between and across different disciplines. And But I think the field of memory studies and the journal tends to mobilize scholarship driven by problem or topic rather than by a kind of a singular method or tradition. And I think that, you know, divergence in backgrounds and assumptions must be highlighted and certainly deliberately engaged with and negotiated rather than wished away. You know, I think it's only by encouraging kind of an open and a careful contesting of concepts can we exploit really the strengths of this, you know, quite daunting range of disciplines, you know, from neurobiology to narrative theory, developmental to the post-colonial, the computational to the cross-cultural, you know, which all drive the collective and various enterprises involved. I don't want to go on too long because I want to much more interested in what my colleagues say, but what's always struck me is that memory, very similar phenomena, or at least aspects of phenomena, are studied in very different fields that never speak to each other. And a wonderful example of that is the study of so-called flashbulb memory. You know, the where were you when question, the idea that we can vividly remember a particular either personal or public event and imagine it, it's like photographic memory, imagine it if it happened as if it happened yesterday. And we can remember with great vivid clarity all the aspects associated with our experiencing of that event, of that moment of hearing the news of Kennedy's assassination. Of course, you know, this is where many flashbulb memory studies, as I call them, people turn to in terms of, you know, one of the great original flashbulb memory events, the assassination of JFK. And many people have been interviewed subsequent to that event who would still have a living memory of that event, i.e. they could remember where they were when that event was reported and when it happened. And a great proportion of them now, particularly in the United States, say they remember seeing the very famous, you know, Zapruder footage of the assassination of JFK. Okay? They remember seeing on television at the time. That's how they experienced the assassination of JFK. And of course they didn't, because the Zapruder film was in a vault in Time Life for 5 years after the event. It's only through the representation, remediation of the Zapruder film through which people have misremembered or at least altered their recollection of where they were, how they experienced that event. Ulrich Neisser, a very famous cognitive psychologist, has done, and his model for studying flashbulb memories has been copied, replicated through many nodal events, including and especially 9/11. And he did some work on the Challenger explosion in the mid-1980s. And one of the key methods of cognitive psychologists is to basically ask people immediately after the event, you know, what were you doing? And get them to write down, answer a questionnaire, what were you doing where you witnessed, saw this event? So Neisser with the Challenger explosion interviewed 100 or 200 of his students that, you know, within 24 or 48 hours of the event. He then went back and interviewed or had researchers interview via questionnaire the same group of people 2 years after that event. And of those people who changed their answer, in other words, those people who had actually said they, you know, they heard about the event, say, walking down the corridor or from their friend or in the streets, those people who had since changed their answer, in other words, their memory had somehow altered in that two-year intervening period, now said they saw it on television. Okay. So Neisser says, okay, fine, that must mean a shift to what he calls TV priority. In some way, the intervening repetition in films and documentaries on news programs has got these people to misremember that they experienced this event on watched this event on television at the time. But bizarrely for me, the cognitive psychologist then, and you can look at all the research over the past 10 years around 9/11, don't think about, well, let's go and investigate the media, let's go and have a look at what images were repeated and when they're repeated and how those were remediated. So for me, cognitive psychology, media and cultural studies are an exemplar of the study of memory from different disciplines that just pass like ships in the night. They don't appear to engage with their methods, their theories, or see a connection there. I'm sure some of you might be able to produce a wonderful example where that is happening. But for the majority of the field, it isn't. And I find that is indicative of the study of memory. I'll just shut up now, or try and shut up, and just say something very briefly about the tremendous consequences, potential consequences of our shift from what has been called a broadcast age to a post-broadcast age. Very little is yet understood about the effects upon memory of what Anderson calls the long tail. What I said at the beginning, simply the vast, massive availability and accessibility of images, text, video of the past, and that which is routinely recorded now and enters very immediately and instantaneously into shaping social and collective memory. And one of the best examples, I think, is 9/11. There was a documentary shown in the States and the UK 6 months after the catastrophe of 9/11, and it declared only 6 months after that this was the most documented event in history. The most documented event in history after just 6 months. That seems an extraordinary claim, but I think it just gives some indication of the shift in the volume and the accessibility of that archive. And there's a lot of interesting research just beginning now on the ways in which the immediate mediation of events translates into a longer-term shaping of events. On that note, I'll shut up. Thank you.
Thank you.